Want me to talk about two things. First of all, how I managed to get an agent and possibly a publisher, and also a little bit about what she referred to rather coyly as espionage. If we start with the actual book itself. I think anybody who's ever done any writing will be aware that you don't suddenly decide I'm going to write a bestseller. It's a little more complicated than that. In my case, I started when I was 17, and I had a letter published by a magazine called the Vauxhall Motorist, which is probably now long defunct. The letter was almost certainly libelous, but it was cleaned up by the editor, and he sent me a fiver. You know, now when I was 17, a fiver. It was a fairly large amount of money. He put petrol in the car for about 2 weeks. So I started from there, and I wrote articles for a variety of magazines, particularly ones called Custom Car, Superbike, Target Gun, and Resident Evil were my main markets in those days. And they were basically about cars, motorcycles, guns, you know, anything else I could really think of. Some were fictional, some were factual, but just a general selection. When I was in the Navy, I also wrote a lot of articles and stories for various publications, some classified, some not. But it wasn't until I got to Andorra and actually had, quote, spare time, unquote, that I could start writing anything that was approximate to a full-length novel or a full-length work. I wrote one book about Andorra, which I published through the Economist magazine, which I don't know if anybody ever got around to buying it, but I sold it reasonably well. But I actually preferred writing fiction. I wrote Overkill, which is, this is the hardback version of it here. That I'd actually got completed immediately before 9/11 happened. And of course, when 9/11 happened, the world changed more or less overnight, so I had to go away and completely rewrite it, because there had to be, if you like, an Arab component, because the world before that was rather different to the world after that. So having completely rewritten Overkill to reflect the changed circumstances, I then started sending it out to agents. Anybody who's done in writing will be aware that trying to get a publisher to take a book is actually extremely difficult. My agent, in fact, gets about 3,000 unsolicited manuscripts a year. And when talking about agents, and indeed about publishers, you have to be aware that most agents and publishers are looking for an excuse to say no. If they actually accept a manuscript, it means they've got to do a lot of work on it. If they say no, the problem basically goes away. So what tends to happen is if there's any reason that they could say no to a manuscript, they certainly will. And as you'll appreciate, picking one or two manuscripts out of maybe 3,000 is a very, very small chance of actually getting selected. I was fortunate having a friend in Penguin, who did not publish me, and I talked to him, and he suggested that the best thing to do was not actually send the manuscript as a whole, but basically send, if you like, a package. The package he suggested, which is what I'd recommend to anybody else, because it does actually seem to work, is send out a synopsis of the book, send out the first three chapters of the book, and send out a covering letter which actually attracts attention. The reason for those things are basically the synopsis shows whether you can plot a book, the first three chapters show whether you can actually write, can you actually hold a reader's attention. But the covering letter is just as important because it does two things. First of all, it introduces you to the publisher or to the agent. It allows them to see if you have anything in your history which is going to be of any interest to the publisher, because these days they publish a book but they also publish the writer. They tend to concentrate on being able to market the writer as much as they try and market the book. And they also like, if possible, for you to put in some kind of an analysis showing where you see your book fitting into the publishing scene at the time. So I spent quite a long time, along with Sally, going through the what I got together and ending up with something that seemed to be reasonably convincing. And I fired it off. Now, my agent is called Luigi Bonomi, who works for a company called Shield and Associates. I started at the letter A, so by the time I got someone to actually accept it, I was halfway through the S's. Okay, so, as you can see, it's not something that happens more or less overnight. What was slightly interesting was I had two books doing the rounds. I had Overkill, this one. I also had another book called Trade-Off, which was a science fiction thriller set entirely in America. And I was trying to market both books, if you like, at the same time. In the same week, in February 2003, I had telephone calls from two London agents, both wanting to pick up one of the books. And the agent who was interested in Trade-Off, her name began with a W, so I'd almost exhausted the alphabet for that particular book. Now, the thing with agents and publishers is you can have as many publishing houses working for you as you like, that's no problem, but you can only have one agent, because when you sign an agency agreement, you basically commit your work to that agency, and they're responsible for your entire literary output. So Sally and I flew back to London to see both agents. The first agent was very sweet. She was a lady called Dinah Wiener. And what put me off her was simply the fact that her writers tended to be people who were writing either chick lit or Aga sagas, or what used to be called domestic science. It was embroidery and cookery and all this kind of thing. And as anybody who's read this book, or anything like that. So when I went to Shiel and Associates, they have a large office just a few doors down from the Dickens Museum in Doughty Street in London. And the first thing I saw when I went in there was a big poster for Wilbur Smith. And I thought, well, that's actually quite a good start. So I signed up, as the opportunity was offered, I signed up there and then. That was in February 2003, and we worked on the book, Luigi Bonomi, the agent, and myself worked on the book, and we set out in May 2003. Went to six UK publishers, and I think two American ones. The American ones didn't express any interest, maybe because at the end of the book about 300,000 Americans get killed, seems to be possibly a bit of a negative indicator. And so we sent out to the six UK publishers. Three of them came back wanting to see me, and the reason for this, I think, is because they need to know if they can work with you. There are some writers out there who will argue ruthlessly for 2.5 weeks over one comma, and the publishers don't like this. They like writers who can actually take editorial criticism, make changes quickly, and stick to deadlines. What they don't want is a prima donna. I've been called a lot of things. I've never actually been called a prima donna. So three of them came back wanting to meet me. That was Hodder, Macmillan, and Orion. And we had a very full day on the 27th of May, I still remember it now, 2003. We went to Hodder's first, then Otto Macmillan, and then finally to Orion. And seemed to get on quite well with all of them. And my agent, who was obviously with me, actually got a phone call from Hodder's making a two-book offer when we were in the meeting with Orion, which was rather nice. Orion then, when I went home then with the certain knowledge that I had at least one publisher wanted to do something with me, when I told Sally she needed to drive the car off the road, that was a fraud 2 minutes. And my agent then went back to Orion and Macmillan to explain what the other offer was. And Orion dropped out straight away because it was more than they wanted to pay. And Macmillan beat it by about 25%, so it went with Macmillan because you go with the money, you know, this one does.
Right.
And that was in May, so I signed a contract with Macmillan in June 2003. It's a measure of how long it takes that this book came out in hardback on the 6th of August 2004. So it's over a year from signature to publication. What was quite interesting for me was that even before Macmillan had made the offer, before Hodder made an offer, the literary agent had already sold the rights to Random House in Germany. So Random House picked up even before Macmillan did, which is rather nice. Since then, Overkill has gone to Holland, that's the Dutch version of it, which is by a company called De Fontaine. They rather embarrassingly call me Britain's answer to Tom Clancy on the front cover. And this is De Fontaine's lead title for this year, which is rather nice.
Well done.
That one. And then we have And this is the German one, where even more embarrassing, they call the commander. which is...
Commander Bond.
I can see, let the Royal Navy is a lieutenant commander, so it's not quite the same thing. Anyway, the publication process, as I said, is quite lengthy, a year or so from, or more than a year from signature to finished product. It goes through basically four stages. I write it, that's the easy bit. It then goes to Macmillan. Macmillan have readers who look at the book, and they will make comments. And those comments go to the editor pass on to me, and then we either incorporate them or don't incorporate them as we feel fit. Then the editor goes through as well. He makes detailed comments on it, and those get incorporated. Then it goes through copy editing, and copy editing is a highly detailed process. And this is where they do things like making sure that the hero, who starts off as 6 foot tall, blonde haired, blue eyed, doesn't turn into a 3 foot six stubby black dwarf, you know, by the end of the book. And also, as I was saying at the table over there a few minutes ago, you make sure that if there's a pregnancy in the book, it lasts for 9 months, not 2 years. At the end of all that lot, this is all done basically with whatever I've supplied, whether it be hard copy, excuse my voice, but I've got a bit of a cold, hard copy or electronic transmission. But at that stage, when the copy editing is finished, it then goes into typesetting, which is where they produce the proof pages. Now, in the case of Overkill, they also produce this, which is known as an uncorrected bound proof. The Americans call it a proof copy. And this is basically the proof pages simply bound into a paperback with a monochrome cover. And this is actually given out to the Macmillan sales reps, and they go around the country trying to sell this rather dull-looking book. And it's also given out to anybody in Macmillan and anybody else who wants it just to read, because if they can find the mistakes in it, they can go back to the editor, and we can end up with, hopefully, a slightly better final version. That's a proof copy. And then on, we went through all that lot. In August 2004, we published in the UK the hardback version of Overkill, which is this. That was published simultaneously with this, which is the what's called the trade paperback. You've probably seen these in airports. These are the full-size paperback versions, which are designed for export sales only, basically. And the initial sales figures are quite encouraging. So that's actually rather nice. That's more or less it from the point of view of that particular book. As things stand at the moment, I'm on a two-book deal with Macmillan. The second book has been accepted by Macmillan, and I just last week finished going through the proof pages. So that will be coming out probably, I guess, for July or August this year. The paperback version, the mass market paperback version of Overkill, which is the normal small size paperback, comes out on the 17th of June. And we're hoping Macmillan will put some kind of advertising budget behind that, because they did nothing for the hardback, which is actually fairly common. They got me onto BBC local radio. I was on 10 or 11 BBC radio channels over a week, 1 week period, and had a 45-minute interview on LBC as well. But that was the only publicity. But that's actually fairly normal for a first-time novel in today's harsh climate, as they say, and all the rest of it. I'm working at the moment on book number three, which is called Prophecy. The second book is called Pandemic. This book is, broadly speaking, about nuclear terrorism, for want of a better expression. Pandemic is about biological warfare. And the third book, which I'm writing now, is back to the nuclear threat, but in a rather different way. It's basically nuclear blackmail this time. I've got a fourth book on the stocks as well called Manhunt. I'm also, my agent asked me to write a TV series, believe it or not. So I'm trying to do that as well. That's... if anybody's seen Spooks, it's going to be a bit like Spooks, if we can tell it, of course. In my spare time, I'm writing another non-fiction book called Uncommon Sense. So that's the publishing side of things from my point of view. Anybody got any questions on that? Anything you'd like to know?
Yes. How many words?
Oh, sorry.
How many words in your book?
In this one, about 165,000.
Around 25?
165.
Approximately how much was changed from the original
submissions to the final book, how many percentages of the manuscript?
One or 2%, that was all. Okay. It was pretty, because with Luigi, I'd done a lot of work on it beforehand, so it was pretty much, my editor in fact said it didn't need editing, which is rather nice. Oh. The second book, however, did a lot of editing. Okay. All right.
You said that there was, I think, almost a year gap between your signing and the book being published. Is this a terribly stressful time in case something happens, given the nature of what you write about, that may come and either preempt your book or in a way put your book in history?
Yes. The short, snappy answer. It's also terribly stressful now. I mean, every morning I wake up thinking there'll be an email from Macmillan saying it's all been a big mistake. You know, really, honestly.
Where did you get the idea of Overkill?
I had it knocking around for a long, long time, and I had gone. Overkill, actually, this is about the. Probably the 10th rewrite of it completely. I had the idea, I wrote it in the first person, in fact the first time round, which simply didn't work, so I had to ditch the whole thing and start over again in the third person, or the global view. And I played around with that for ages, changing various things and adding bits and pieces, taking bits and pieces out. But the idea I've had for ages, and I can't remember where it came from.
Are you aware it might happen?
Absolutely.
Oh, no.
This week. That actually, when I was doing the BBC radio interviews, that was the principal query that they had. You know, how realistic was it, and could it actually happen? And the short answer is possibly it could. Sorry.
I'm interested in the publicity side. I have two or three friends who are novelists, and Andrew himself also, and they have done an immense amount of work going round to. Circles and institutions and luncheon clubs and all this kind of thing, which apparently has enormously increased their sales.
Yeah.
Did your agents or your publishers ask you to do this, bearing in mind you live in Andorra and not in the UK?
No, but that will happen with the paperback.
Oh, it will.
They wanted to save all that for the paperback, because that's where the marketing budget is going to go.
Okay, so and then you will start going on tour to these awful places.
That is the idea.
Bad luck.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to know, the torture is real, and number two, we know the love is just going to happen.
The torture scenes in the book are actually toned down.
I had to keep my eyes closed, so I actually have not read.
Okay.
Not that.
There's a very interesting book called The Aquarium by a man called Viktor Suvorov. He worked for the GRU, which is the Russian Military Intelligence Organization. All new recruits to the GRU are shown an 8mm film of a man being fed feet first into a furnace. And this is the person who had offended the GRU, who was an agent who betrayed them in some way. And they put him in, they pull him out, they put him in, they pull him out. And it goes on about half an hour, apparently. And this is a kind of an attention getter. If anybody thinks when they join the GRU that they might be better off employed by the Americans, for example, the film is intended to remind them that it's not a good idea. And that's true. I mean, that's actually true.
I have to admit, I got in trouble here. I was taking a course, Masters of Writing, in California, in a very liberal school. I mean, we're talking, girl next to me had tattoos all over her body and this and that. And the kids were writing very violent things, which upset me. And so I just went full force, and I talked about this young woman who's kind of going mad in her life, and she actually was put in a grinder by Saddam Hussein's son, but she was happy that it was head first, because she was having a bad hair day. And he took this serious, I mean, I wasn't being serious, but... You're scared,
is it?
And then,
okay, I want to know,
is
Sally going to
be writing the sex scene?
There's no sex in Overkill. There's no sex in Pandemic, the second one. There'll be a little bit of sex in Prophecy.
No, I read your website, and you had written.
Yeah.
know what it is, right?
Yes, yes.
That was right. Paul Bridger reappear.
Yes, he's the serious character, so he's everyone.
I ordered and received your book from Amazon.
Yeah.
And it dematerialized before I had a chance to read it. Is this some method of increasing sales?
Did you say dematerialized?
It's vanished.
Really? Not doing me.
Special pattern on it.
No, not that I'm aware of. Okay.
You've
okay.
got to be
Amazon. Okay. Yeah. Most people don't have a problem with Amazon. It seems to work quite well.
I've got mine from Amazon, no problem.
Yeah, okay. Claire asked me to talk a little bit about espionage. I can't obviously stray into classified areas, but I thought I'd talk very briefly about how much we're all under electronic surveillance. You may have heard of a thing called Echelon. Anybody heard of Echelon? Okay, Brian's heard of Echelon, obviously. Okay, Echelon is an interesting organisation. It's a joint US, UK, Canadian, Australian, New Zealand surveillance system, which monitors all emails, faxes and telephone calls which originate, terminate or pass through any of the countries involved. It has an annual budget of $9 billion.
Located where? Scotland?
No. Look, I'll get that in there if I may. $9 billion, which equates to about £1 million, $1 million per hour. Okay? It's the biggest employer in the state of Maryland. It's run by, in America, by the American National Security Agency, the NSA. In the UK, it is based primarily at GCHQ at Cheltenham, but it's also got two satellite stations, one at Morwenstow and the other one at Menwith Hill in Yorkshire. So there are three UK components to this. It's also got other agencies in places like Germany. And it's basically a worldwide net. It does two things. It monitors emails and other electronic means of communication, looking out for particular words, words like Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, obviously, but also bomb. Anything like bomb and gun,
attack,
and
president.
What
about CIA?
Okay.
I always put club instead
okay.
of CIA.
Yeah. Probably a good idea.
I the club.
Yeah. And... it monitors, looks out for words in multiple languages, because obviously it does, it's not just English, they listen out in a number of languages. They also do a thing called voice print analysis, which means that if someone like Osama bin Laden, whose voice is well known, ever makes a telephone call to somebody in America, for example, which is an extremely unlikely scenario, but if he did, it would be detected very, very quickly indeed. And basically the monitoring is done by computers, but it's they have the ability to immediately transfer the call or whatever it is to a human interpreter if any interesting keywords come up, or if a voice print analysis shows that the person making the call or receiving the call is interested in the security forces. The take from Echelon goes to some 300 agencies worldwide, including in Britain, the secret intelligence service, SIS, and MI5, the security service. It's also of interest, just diverting slightly from Echelon, Echelon is not the only one. There's one called Blue Crystal, which is run by the National Reconnaissance Office in the States, and the FBI have got their very own one called Carnival, which is a wonderful name. In the UK, one thing which is rather interesting, you're probably aware that telephone tapping in the UK is not something which is apparently done very often. The two organisations normally involved are one, the security service, the MI5, and the second, the secret intelligence service, SIS or MI6. In all cases, they work on the same routine. If a telephone tap is required, then the requesting organisation has to contact the Home Secretary in the case of MI5 or the Foreign Secretary in the case of SIS, and get a warrant, and the warrant lasts for 1 month. So the telephone can be monitored for 1 month only. Then the reason for the tapping has to be re-justified, and this is a continual ongoing process. What's slightly worrying is that there's a loophole, and the loophole is that if any member of the special branch, which is the Division of Metropolitan Police, which is actually the arresting arm of MI5 has no powers of arrest, if anybody in special branch decide that a particular telephone may be being used by a suspected criminal, he can actually approach a senior BT official and get an unlimited duration telephone tap placed on that line without anybody being aware of it, which I find slightly worrying. Sorry.
Have you as an author, I mean, now that you're not presumably still in the service or whatever, keep up with the changes in that kind of technology and information?
I have a lot of contacts.
How good are you?
Any rates reveal?
And I've pretty much finished now, but I would just like to leave you one interesting thing, which if you get hold of Prophecy, you'll find a bit more about. When the KGB was in its heyday, which is the Russian intelligence service, the KGB instructed a manufacturer based near the Ural Mountains to manufacture a particular kind of atomic munition. And this was what became known as the nuclear suitcase bomb. It was so called because it fitted inside a box, which is more or less the shape and size of a suitcase. It had a yield of 1 kiloton, which is equivalent to approximately 1,000 tons of TNT. To put that into perspective, if you put it at the safe basement of Canary Wharf and detonated it, you'd be left with a pile of building material. I mean, it would certainly totally destroy the building. The KGB instructed 250 of these units to be made, and the Russians can't find 84 of them. And that was the source for that is a 1997 statement by a man called Alexander Lebed, who was the former Russian national security advisor, or the equivalent thereof. Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Valerie.
I have a question.
Sorry, what happened? Did you?
What you said about this, whether it's tapping or infection of emails and so on, that in itself sets up a supposition that we are all suspect. Every single person is suspect. Is this a new state of mind made possible by the computer technology? Or has in fact this been going on a lot longer?
An American Secretary of State years ago said that gentlemen do not read other people's mail. But actually, intelligence services have been doing this for centuries, basically. It's just that now, with electronic communications and with the ability to tap into all sorts of different sources of electronic data, it's become a hell of a lot easier.
Because it makes a nonsense in a way of privacy, of human rights,
yeah.
And so on, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. To put that in this perspective, the National Security Agency has a weekly output of intelligence of 200 tons weight of paper. Weekly.
Do they recycle it?
Who reads it?
I have no idea what they do with it. It's all
classified. Lots of green, lots of green.
Very. Yeah. No, I know. It's an awful situation. I do find it very disturbing. That's why I'm in Andorra.
Are you ever approached by the government to ask why, how you know so much and so on? Are you under threat in any way at all?
No, not so far.
Wait till it comes out of the paper.
I did one of the questions that when I was at the interview with Hodder, one of the things they asked me then was how much of it of the book was actually based on my personal experience. And I explained it was actually a novel and, consequently, fiction. But also, did I require MOD clearance for it? Because Andy McNabb, for example, he needs MOD clearance every time he writes a book. But I deliberately went through the book and I eliminated everything which was actually... had any kind of security information whatsoever. Because otherwise, Andy McNabb's last novel, I think, took 3 months to clear.
Yeah.
And that puts a real glitch in the publishing process.
I'm interested in your remarks about coming to Andorra to feel safer, if I can. One of my former neighbours, used to be my neighbour, was a retired person from the Naval Intelligence. And he did a lot of work in the Falklands.
Yeah.
And
can we really speak up?
Sorry, yes.
Or maybe use microphone.
I was just explaining that a neighbour of mine was in naval intelligence, and he was still working when he first came here, and spent long holidays here, and even longer periods working in unusual places. He was responsible in the Falkland Islands for having a general from the Argentinian army as his prisoner, and the picture was up on the wall. He obviously was vetted, positively vetted, at regular intervals. And what really disturbed me was that I was told by my neighbour that they wanted to know all about me, the neighbour. And I thought, well, that's really none of their business. Oh, yes, he said, everything is their business. They want to know who my friends are, what I do when I'm here, who my neighbours are, and of course I had to tell them the truth.
Right, there are basically two types of vetting employed by the British Intelligence Council. One is what's called negative vetting. Now, negative vetting is a covert process. They don't need to tell anybody about it, and all they're doing is they're checking records, basically. If you have an uncle who's a secretary of the local Communist Party, this obviously raises a red flag. If you've got a brother who's in prison for drug smuggling, this again raises a red flag. It wouldn't necessarily preclude somebody being approved for access to classified documents, but obviously it does tend to make people think more clearly. Negative vetting clears most people up to secret, and that's, for example, the vetting which is applied to everybody who joins the armed forces in an officer rank. Positive vetting, which is what Stephen was talking about, is incredibly thorough, and it's a long process. It takes several months to complete, and it involves absolutely everybody. They start off from conception, fundamentally, and work their way through to the day before yesterday. And everybody, they talk to people who were at school with the person involved, they talk to previous sexual partners if they can find them and if they're willing to talk, obviously. People at work who work with the person involved, and it takes a long, long time. That clears you up to top secret, which is the grade above secret. What people may not be aware is there are some 30 grades or so above top secret, including things like cosmic top secret, royal, ultra secret, and so on. But interestingly, when you start looking at things which are actually above top secret, generally speaking, these are quite specific classifications for particular projects. So you could have, for example, a top secret security clearance, but you wouldn't necessarily be entitled to look at a document which is top secret classified, but in a particular compartment of its own. Okay. I don't explain that very well, but that's where it works. So,
two questions. Why did you choose the name James Bansford? Why not Peter Smith?
Peter Smith is a very boring name.
Lots of them.
Would you give me a background? Who are you?
Who am I?
James Barrington.
Peter Smith. My background is military. I was in the Royal Navy for 21 years. Basically, I started off as a pilot, finished up doing, moved from being a pilot to air traffic control. I had a detached retina, so that stopped me flying. And I then moved on to what I infamously refer to as staff jobs. And that's as far as I can tell you.
I was very amazed reading your book of how accurate your locations and your names in the subway. I think I'm a specialist in airfields and so on in the Soviet Union. And I haven't been able to pick up any mistakes. Where did you get the information from about the Russian locations?
From my own experience of when I was still employed by the Queen, and also just by research. You know, there's no substitute for research. As anybody who's read Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code will be aware, you know, the Andorra railway line, and Steve actually picked me up on one thing in the book which nobody else has spotted. He found that I was thinking specifically of the place in a port called Tirane, which actually 100 miles.
Tirana.
From the coast, so I've had to change that in the paper.
And Riga.
And Riga, yes, that was a, yes. That's also been changed. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
You mentioned Dan Brown a minute ago, and I read a book, which is about the NSA and the supercomputers they've got, which can decrypt all the encrypted emails. Do you think that's
rubbish. It's rubbish. They do, I mean, in fairness, they do use supercomputers. Matter of interest, GCHQ at Cheltenham, they've just commissioned a £1 billion building, which is known colloquially as the Donut, because if you look at it from the air, it looks exactly like a strange type of donut. That has an underground chamber the size of the Albert Hall, which contains their principal supercomputers. It's bomb-proof. The entire building covers 40 acres, thereabouts. It employs 4,500 staff, and they have linguists on their staff who speak 67 languages fluently. And now, the GCHQ is a much smaller organisation than the NSA. But they do use supercomputers, yes, but the Dan Brown concept of having a supercomputer that apparently has a life of its own, I mean, this is pretty flaky, frankly. Right. Anything else before my voice gives out completely?
Why James
Darrington?
You never really
asked. Oh, sorry. Peter says a boring name, I think. No. I grew up for a lot of my childhood in a village called Harston, and the village, two villages down, is called Barrington. It's a very, very pretty little village, and I like the name anyway, and I like the name James.
Can I just ask you, was it your agent who said your name was boring, or was it
the
sort of
me?
Brilliant, and I don't think it's a trial run for all these ones you're going to have to do in England, but you're going to be a huge success.
Yeah.